Everybody, could I have your attention? This is the second class, and we're going to try and finish up the attention to the development of the fund itself, the permanent fund itself. And next week, we'll start on the dividend, which is a different sort of an animal. Steve leaves tomorrow, but today we have Charles Wolforth, whose father was on with Steve and I yesterday on Talk of Alaska. Charles is a columnist, regular columnist for the Alaska Dispatch. And you also have some connection to APRN, because they wouldn't let you come on with me. I asked for you in Anchorage, and they said, no, he already has a show. We can't do that. It looks incestuous. That's exactly what they said. So I don't know what that connection is, but anyway, Charles wrote this book, which I have talked about a lot and offered to you. He has copies of this in his basement, he told me. But it's out of print now, and it is the single most detailed, intimate, and readable of the discussions of the permanent fund's early history. And Dave Rose, who Steve, for instance, I don't even have to have Charles advocate for him, but Steve says he should be the first Alaska saint because he really, really did a lot. He was the manager for the fund for the first 10 years. He really set up the investment systems and just was a very credible fellow, very honorable fellow. And Charles wrote the book with him and wrote it all down and was very intimate with him. So I'm going to actually follow this book and ask Charles questions, and we can sort of intercede if we want to, but there's hardly a better person to get in this regard, both because Charles wrote the book and because he was so intimate with David Rose. So, with that being said, is there anything I don't have any resume for you. You might want to talk about how you came to all this and whatever.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, Don?
Yeah, I was hoping he would also talk about when he grew up, his dad's positions and so forth, because not everybody got to catch the bobcat. But his dad was in a position to have table talk at the house.
Right. Yeah, I'm one of the few kids in my third grade classroom who knew the difference between a revenue bond and a GO bond.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was really
when it starts to matter.
Yeah.
You know?
So my family came to Alaska in 1966. My dad Eric Wolforth was a Wall Street finance attorney who was lured north by Bill Egan because they're rebuilding from the earthquake down in Anchorage, and they needed that kind of expertise. And the family story goes that he was lured north with the prospect that he could be Commissioner of Revenue, and a very young man. The governor was on the dock when the ferry arrived in Juneau, and then we took the next stop. We came to Haines, and my brother, who was like 8 years old at the time, said, like, well, where's the governor in this town? Usually we get met by the governor.
So got to be an expectation. Yeah.
So the other thing that happened in 1966 is that Wally Hickel beat Bill Egan. So
that's right.
The commissioner of revenue is off the table, and my dad is writing wills and taking care of fender benders for a few years. It's a big come down, but he did get really involved in writing the statutes in the early years of the state having to do with finance. He wrote all the statutes for ADA and HFC, and he was the investment advisory board when the permanent fund was first created, working on the original investment plans. That's how I sort of definitely had some advanced interest in this topic. I ended up writing the book with Dave because, he was a family friend. I remember him around the house when I was a little guy, but I have always been a writer. I was recruited to write a book with Wally Hickel as a ghostwriter in the mid-90s, and then Dave wanted to do a book, and you know, didn't have the sort of writing ability to do it himself, hired me to do this. He was very ill at the time, and actually passed away, like, as the final words of the book were he'd read them and died within days of the final words of the book being completed. And then did a book, a similar book with Vic Fisher after that. Really interesting process. The way I don't know how other people do it, but the way I've done these books is to sit down with the person and essentially download their entire life. We'll do sort of an initial interview to figure out what's the outline of the book going to be, and then just do many, many, many interviews, and then go back and do all the research in the old newspapers and the documentary research to find out how they've misremembered everything. And
I know how that goes.
Yeah, my biggest lesson was, like, nobody remembers their own life accurately. Like, whatever you think happened, that's not what happened.
No, they remember it accurately, only it didn't really happen that way.
That's right. But believe me, Hickel in that regard was
I would think that would be, you'd have to do the fact check on that one.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say, this is the one you did with Vic Fisher. Is that his life story? That is the most compelling book. How many of you have read that book? But I mean, that he used to live here, and we have association with. He was a faculty member when I was a researcher at the university, and it's an absolutely unbelievable story. A human life that has that diversity and width of experience, breadth of experience is just astounding.
But called From Russia with Love.
Yeah. And the guy was asked to be the governor of Chukotka late in his life because he's not a Russian and he speaks Russian. what a chance. Anyway, I wanted to start with about half this book is previous to the Alaska Permanent Fund, and then part two is the Alaska Permanent Fund. And I'm going to start with that because Charles starts with, and I'm going to refer to reading and stuff. I don't want to do too much of that, but I had asked him to enlarge upon the personal aspects that he knows in depth beyond what's on the text. But he sets it up to talk about the problem of wealth in democracies. How does a democracy save for the future? When democracy works, citizens speak for themselves. Joining together voluntarily for community benefits they cannot achieve on their own. We hire police and build roads and government, but we must stand together to do so. But voters who approve those actions do so for their own good, not primarily to benefit others. And it goes on to say, this includes many people who will move into the state in the future. Borrowing in the name of the unborn is easy. Yeah, too easy, I think, sometimes. But it would seem counterintuitive for people in possession of large collective resources to save their money for undetermined future purposes by unknown future people. I've heard it said very avariciously in Alaska, what has posterity ever done for me? Anyway, theory would suggest that in a democracy, everyone would want to share a full share of the wealth right away through collective possession of goods or just dividing up the surplus. This is not what happened in Alaska. So anyway, you talk about how it all came down. Steve talked about that well. What happened when the Permanent Fund started to go into operation as a corporation? Can you expand on that? Because he was the first, Dave Rose was the first executive director of the Permanent Fund, and then it became, I guess, that's what it always is.
Well, this is the that period after the constitutional amendment passed in 76 to about 1980, when the purpose of and structure of the fund was established, was really the most important period for the creation of the permanent fund we have now. But going back to that paragraph you just read, and I'm reminded of working on my book, The Whale and Supercomputer, with Dave Norton, which was about climate change, which is another really good example of this. How does a democracy create benefits for people who aren't born yet? That's the climate change issue, right? I mean, we can go ahead and use all the fossil fuels we want. We're old enough, and it's really not going to affect us. It's going to affect our grandchildren or great-grandchildren. And if you think of society as a social contract, right, where you do, you like sort of the the John Locke version of society where
that's a big if.
Well, I mean, that's sort of our that's enlightenment model of society, right? Like you contribute to society because what you get back is security. You get back the ability to, you know, well, what are you getting back from people who haven't been born yet and won't be born until after you die? No, I guess you get to pass on your genes, right? You hope that they'll be on Earth, but that's really the issue with the permanent fund is, well, why in the world would people who are here save money that we could use for somebody to spend like after we're dead, right? It doesn't, especially since it's not like necessarily our heirs. We don't even know. I mean, my kids are all leaving the state, you know?
Yeah, mine too. Yeah. They are. So, they have left the state. Left the building.
So that's that big question. And I think the answer is that it was a very unique moment in history. And you have to go back. I'm sure Steve Cooper talked about the $900 million lease sale.
Yeah.
That was, you know, my favorite quote from reading the material that was written at the time of the vote in 76 was an essay by Jay Hammond where he's talking about the different purposes of the fund. He's saying, well, it could be used for economic development. It could be used for dividends. It could be used for this. It could be used for that. And he says, and I can only think of 900 million other reasons. And really, the truth of the matter is that everybody, you know, that going into that vote, Bob Atwood, the editor of the Anchorage Times, said, well, this is going to allow us to build the Susitna Dam. And Jamie Love, who was the ACPR guy, said, well, this is going to allow us to have daycare centers in every city in Alaska. I mean, everybody had their own idea. Like Clem Tillion was saying, well, this is going to keep us from spending money. Somebody else said, well, this means it will be a longevity bonus. The reason it passed is because everybody had their own idea what it was going to be. If you'd had any one of those, it probably wouldn't have passed. And that led Elmer Rasmussen to make sort of the quote that I think everybody who's around and has studied this honestly agrees with, was the original purpose of the permanent fund was a negative purpose. It was just saying, don't waste the money.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be money here. Let's just not waste all
put
of it.
Put it aside and don't, you can't spend it.
And there was no positive purpose determined as like what it's actually for. So that time period from 76 to 80 was the real battle when that was decided of the purpose that we have now, which is a fund which is essentially invested outside of Alaska. It's not used for economic development. It's essentially counter-cyclical, so when our economy in Alaska goes down, it's based on the stock market outside. It doesn't go down. We keep getting the money coming in. And then Hammond's big goal, which was to have a dividend, gets half the money. Erlis Dzerjolowski wanted it to have inflation proofing, so that gets a significant portion of the money.
Talk about Erlis. Mm-hmm. She is the most abused politician, I think, in the entire state. She has all through your book and all through a lot of other books, Hickel's book, she's always getting screwed by, in metaphorical terms, by the political system. She's being betrayed. She always has a steady, upright kind of a view of things, and she never was quite rewarded or recognized for it. And I just wanted to comment on that because she's one of these figures who's done mostly the right things in her life and never saw the success that others have done.
I think it's because she's a woman in that generation. And
if you
look at the women who are sort of resentful of what's happening to Hillary Clinton and the fact that she always gets treated very unfairly, I think that resentment is the same thing of women who came up in that generation and just got treated unfairly all the way down the line. And Erlis definitely did.
Well, let me see where I went from there. Okay. Oh, Jim Rhode and the effect. I wanted to go to, I didn't realize until Steve came here that there was this group of wizards that were hired that gave the impression to the legislators that they wouldn't need to ever use the permanent fund earnings for state government. But the context was crucial because that was during the Iranian Revolution, and oil prices went up. And he said they said they would stay up, and that we would be making all this money, and we would never need to use it. We could give it away, and that set up a whole lot of controversy, and that set up the situation where the legislature eliminated the income tax. I didn't know they had this professional advocacy to do so. It just kind of makes me very, I would have thought they would be a little more cautious. But I think these guys really, really told them what they wanted to hear. And were totally misled, but it just opened a door for profligate doing away with the tax system.
Right.
And I'm going to show next week a video where five governors come together in 1993, the five then governors who were alive. It was Miller, Hickel, Steve Cooper, Sheffield, and Hammond. And to a person, they all say, in 1993, which is only 13 years after it happened, that it was a terrible mistake, and that we shouldn't have done it. But they all just dove in head first when they were told by these guys. So,
well, I think that, you know, there's I think that's very true. I think it's also important to put it in perspective, which is that even if we had a huge income tax now, it still wouldn't be enough to cover the budget deficit.
Oh, but it never was. We knew that from the get-go.
Right. It was.
We knew we couldn't fund this state without some kind of revenue.
Never has been able to be.
Yeah.
And even if we kept the income tax, it's not like we wouldn't have a problem now. We'd still have a big problem. I think, you know, what one of the things that happened was it wasn't just that people were sold a bill of goods. It's just incredibly difficult to predict commodity prices and economic conditions. So there were headlines back in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s saying that, you know, that oil income was just going to increase and that we were going to be getting hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And there's this perception that it was essentially unlimited oil. At one time, Alaska's oil income was bigger per capita than anyone else on the planet Earth. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, anywhere else.
Well, that's because per capita was very low.
we were this little island of, you know, 400,000 people who just had all this oil.
We happened to be sitting on the largest oil field ever found in North America and producing like more than 25% of all the oil, all the petroleum used in the United States. So it was crazy amounts of money. And that's really why we got the permanent fund and got it set up the way we did. It was because there was so much money flowing around that they couldn't spend it fast enough. You know, they were spending it and totally overheated the economy and wasted enormous amounts of it. You hear some of these legislators at the time, it was too much trouble to compile the capital budget in Juneau, so they just put a terminal in each legislator's office, and any staff member could just type projects in. So I've heard staff members tell me about, like, hey, the senior center called, they need a van. So you just go over the terminal, type in a van. They've got it. This is how money was being spent. So in that environment, that's the environment when you can start taking billions of dollars and put it into an inviolate future savings account, because who cares? Money is, like, free. And also is potentially, I mean, that's something that happens so rarely on the planet Earth. That's why this is the first permanent fund that's ever been in existence, because that was such an unusual circumstance.
And that should not be understated, because you stay right there in that first chapter that, you know, we're the first. We were the first to do something like the permanent fund. And lots of people, I put on the website Steve Cooper's World Bank paper, and he recommends, and he talked about this, he's talked about this several times, he recommends, and he's gotten encouragement from the Norwegians, but the Norwegians that I have listened to, I haven't talked to them, but I have listened to, do not ever advocate for a dividend. They all advocate for a fund, but the Norwegians have not used, they don't use, just like we shouldn't have, they don't use any of their income for operation of government. They maintain their tax structure, and they pay for their ongoing stuff. They have free education, they have free health care, and they have a tremendous pension fund. But they don't fund the operation of government with their income from their fund.
But and that's a response to what's been called the resource curse or the Dutch disease.
Yes.
Because it hit yep. you know, it hit the Dutch first and destroyed Venezuela, destroyed Nigeria. I mean, finding oil, it can be really the worst thing that happens to you.
Yeah, there's a book called The Paradox of Plenty, mm-hmm. which is about the only good story in there is the Norwegian story. The Norwegians have done it very, very well. We did it pretty well. Did it better than it came up yesterday in the lecture on the radio comparative with the Heritage Fund in Alberta. And I've studied that. There have been comparative reports and all that sort of thing. But they didn't, they kept their money entirely for operations of government and expenditures of capital.
Right. And that government. Failure is really what saved us, because that had already happened when the 76 to 80 time period was taking place. And they had done sort of the Bob Atwood version of, we'll invest it in Alberta, and then we'll get the benefit of these projects, and they'll also pay us back into our permanent fund. But the problem is, when you invest in the same place you're getting the money from, you don't have this counter-cyclical thing, and so they lost the money.
Quick question. Let me get Don first, because he's been trying. Yeah.
In relation to how Norway...
Speak up, because...
In relation to how Norway... didn't use it for government, isn't it true that they did invest it in, not to say they did it as poorly as Alberta, but they did invest it in infrastructure, if I'm not mistaken. So capital projects, which, you know, we're saying are part of government, might have gotten some of that fund money, if I'm not mistaken. But
I think you're right, but I don't know. I don't know that for sure.
A lot of the electrical grid, highways, seaports.
They have the highest number of cement bridges I have ever seen in the world. They did when I spent a year in Norway, for those of you who may not know that, as a Fulbright research scholar in 1985-86. My wife and I both agree, one of the best years of our life. Daughter was only a year old, and the son was only five, and he went to a school. But I had a chance to see the early emergence of a wealthy Norway. It wasn't really, but right now their sovereign wealth fund had gone up to about $900 billion at one point. It's now at about $700 billion. It's lost huge amounts of money in the various stock market thing. But it holds about 1% of all the stock value on Earth. It's a huge, huge barometer. Another thing that the Norwegian fund does, which I have talked about in other contexts, is it actually has, and this was exposed by WikiLeaks, because the U.S. Ambassador's office, U.S. Embassy in Norway was complaining about ethical constraints put on the investment of the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund, because the U.S. did not want those ethical constraints. But this really pisses me off. But because there was an effort or two. I mean, I know that Elmer Rasmussen had set up and really was instrumental in ethically and professionally determining the attitudes and plans for how to operate the fund. And he advocated very strongly for the prudent investor rule. And prudent investor rule is that thou shalt invest for maximum profit and minimum risk. That's a very simplistic view of it, but that's the intent. But without any ethical constraints. I mean, you can invest in gambling and booze and weapons and all kinds of things that have ethical questions about them. Well, for a while there was a group of Alaskans, which I was part of, that tried to get the permanent fund to divest from, we have a big holding in Philip Morris, divest from cigarettes, causes cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Rick Steiner, who some of you may know, got on the radio one night. I was driving down College Road on my way home from work, and he gets on the radio and he says, look, we need to talk about divesting from some of these unethical investments that the permanent fund invests in. I think that's not imprudent. And the question that I used to bring this up was, is it prudent to be ethical? If you're a prudent investor, is it prudent to be ethical? And you know, nobody ever answered that question adequately, but it's a good question.
Well, Dave,
don't start with me.
And we address that in the book, and I think Dave very, very strongly opposed having any kind of ethical investment rule, because I think he felt he was the only way to navigate his path, which was investing on behalf of all Alaskans, was to be completely blind to anything but investment returns, because he saw an incredible slippery slope of taking any investment off the table for any reason other than investment success. And I think that was one, you know, in his 10 years of turning the permanent fund into this sort of money machine, which we just sort of set aside and just like, oh, well, it works, it's a black box, we don't have to worry about it. That was one of the things he did that was very, very wise, which I probably wouldn't have done. And obviously you wouldn't have either.
I certainly wouldn't have.
But I mean, but it was successful, and because of that, we stopped sort of second-guessing the fund, which people in the first 10 years, they were constantly second-guessing it and saying, you should do this, you should invest in that, you should sell, you should buy, you should, you know, not be in this sector, you should be in that sector. By developing this confidence of like a very clear, simple set of rules, he navigated that.
Well, I can see that it has worked in that guise, but Norwegian's system has also worked.
There's a huge difference between Alaska and Norway, which is that we have an incredibly diverse society, and much more diverse than they do. And we have a
a far more unethical society. I mean, if that's true, isn't that also true? I mean,
in terms of Alaska, though. But I mean, if you were to say, I mean, what, you know, what about guns? I mean, why would we support gun manufacturers, right?
Should we not go there?
Well, I mean, or maybe we should only invest in guns. I mean, as soon as you open that up, you are in a can of worms. It's completely unmanageable, especially when you're talking about the first 10 years of the fund. Mm-hmm. And his attitude was, if you go to the legislature and pass a law that says we can't invest in cigarettes, we would be happy to obey that law. But we're not going to, as investment advisors, sort of go out and decide what's ethical and what's not on behalf of Alaskans.
Yeah, and I just wanted to point that out because the questions have been asked. And I wanted to finish the story with Rick Steiner because I think it's so funny. He's asked by the commentator on APRN, well, what do you think is the case and what would you do differently? And he says, well, if all you care about is the return on investment, why just don't we take the whole corpus of the fund and invest it in the Colombian cocaine cartel? Because, boy, we'd get a hell of a return on that. And you know, the point is well taken there. What's that?
High risk.
Oh, yeah, high risk. Yeah, and there are other implications of how that money might be used. But you know,
before we get off of Norway, I was informed by an individual that Norway is all corporate and individual taxes is very, very high. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah.
Is that, and their tax structure? We can't really say that Norway's doing really good on their fund if they're getting it from the people or the companies that are working there. That's how come their economy is growing so well is because of their fund.
But I think
am I right?
I think the story in Norway is that they, what they figured out, which was a good idea, was they segregated the oil income from the real economy. Because what's happened in other places, and you could really argue this has happened in Alaska, which is why we're in the straits that we are now, is the oil income destroys the real economy because it inflates prices too much and it makes it too easy to get money through oil. So why run a regular business? Why compete selling widgets if oil money is flowing and all you need to do is get your, you know, hold your bucket out and get some of that? And that's what happened in Venezuela. That's what happened like all over the world. So what Norway did, which I think is very smart, is that they just segregated out the oil. They don't even use the oil. So they operate their oil wells using alternative energy.
I've used this argument in Alaska. I said, you know, it is not enough. People have constantly made the argument that, and in fact, we got a permanent fund dividend in 2008, supposedly for using for our energy costs, you know, an extra $1,200 for energy costs. Well, it doesn't make sense when your resource is most valuable to sell to someone else that you should make it subsidize it for your own use. You should not need to use it if you're going to be smart. It's your most valuable commodity. Don't subsidize your own use of it. That's just not, it's not sensible in any economic concept. So, but that's what we continuously want to do. People say, well, we got this money and our costs are so high, subsidize. When we do with this with PCE, the power cost equalization in the bush, to make electricity affordable in the bush, it's the same sort of thing. You're using oil, essentially, to make electricity available and add subsidy to use it well there, to make it affordable in the bush. Again, Norway doesn't have that problem because the whole country is wired. It's smaller.
They have a real economy, which we don't.
And the peasants of Prus sometimes will eat their corn, and they'll eat their potatoes and sell their corn because they can't afford to eat their corn. That's not the case in Norway. The Norwegians are far healthier. They got a much better health care system. They got a much better future. They've got better education, and the propaganda hides behind what we are told and repeat 1984, which is, yeah, but they pay a lot of taxes. I think one of the big distinctions in Norway is the people own the oil, and here the oil owns the politicians, owns us.
Well said. Let's go on to some of the attitudes. A lot of people, and I'm among them, think that Hammond had a primal kind of influence, and his arguments were often utilized. He originally came up with the idea of Alaska Incorporated on how to use the income, that we would be receiving benefits like you get a one, how do you say, one
share
of stock for every year you were here after statehood. And that essentially you got a seniority bonus. Any of you know who the Zobels were?
Ron and Penny.
And you talk about them, and here you describe some things I didn't know. Did you know the Zobels?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Penny
lives a couple blocks from me.
Yeah, they were young lawyers in love, and they were
right too.
They were right. Yeah, and I knew this too. I really was on top of this. But there was a bumper sticker that went around. I mean, and Steve said this too, or maybe your father did yesterday on the radio. The bumper sticker went around and said, "Nuke the Zobels," because these people were absolutely reviled for actually suggesting that equity be the basis upon which we distribute the permanent fund dividend. And yet, of course, they were right. The Constitution says that, and logical, ethical sense says that. I mean, it's not a question that I think is arguable, but it had to go all the way to the Supreme Court because the state Supreme Court found in favor of Hammond. So they were lawyers. They were former Peace Corps volunteers. These were very, very interesting people.
The Hammond's concept was that that you got a share for every year you lived in Alaska back to 1959, and then every year you continued to live in Alaska, you got an additional share. So then the dividends would be divided up according to how many shares you had. So I arrived in Alaska in 1966, so I would now be getting 50 shares. If somebody moved to Alaska, they would get one share. So I might get $5,000, and they might get $50. And as time went on, this would increase. And the Zobels pointed out, well, we do have an equal protection clause in the Constitution, which says that the government should treat everyone the same. And the Supreme Court looked at that and said, by golly, that's right, it is in there. And so it's obviously, and there's no way to ever make up to get equal to somebody who had been here longer. If you made the mistake of coming here later, you just will always be inferior and always get less money. Hammond was very, very, he almost didn't support the concept of equal dividends because it was just not his idea. He had this idea that people who had been here, especially Alaska Natives, had a superior ownership of Alaska,
and that these resources belonged to the people, and that if they were used by government, they would be siphoned off by wealthy contractors and people who wanted to build big projects who lived in Anchorage, and the money would be wasted. That part was correct. But this concept, and I wrote about a column about this recently, the concept that the money belongs to us as individuals, I mean, he was a very creative thinker, but it's really a fantasy. It does not belong to us as individuals. You know, the resources were transferred to the state of Alaska as a state for the purposes of providing state services. And the Statehood Act says that pretty explicitly. It further says that if any of those resources are ever transferred to an individual, they revert to the federal government. I mean, it couldn't really be much more clear that that's the purpose of it. By virtue of the fact that you've taken the resources and then invested them, and then you're taking the dividend from that, puts it at one remove. But that didn't stop people saying, well, it's my money. You can't take my dividend because I earned it by living in Alaska. You know, because obviously living in Alaska is such a hardship, you got to be paid to do it. I don't know, whatever. But that's just rhetoric. You know, is our money only to the extent that we sort of say as a polity that it's our money? If we say it's not our money, then it's not our money. I mean, it's just a decision that we make, you know, from one year to the next.
I was gonna cite some sections where you talk about Zobel, and you say it took courage for the Zobels to make their stand. Ron Zobel's political aspirations never recovered. I'll bet. Somebody said yesterday on the Talk of Alaska show that people would call up for most of their lives and threaten them with death. They just were just terribly, terribly mistreated for years.
Yeah, Ron ran for the state senate. And I think part of his thinking was, like, the vast majority of people receiving the dividend now are receiving more than they would have, right? Yeah. Because you would have ended up with a small, I mean, we still are a transient population, so you'd end up with a small number of people who are getting huge dividends, and the vast majority of people would be getting tiny dividends.
Yeah.
But it didn't work.
Weren't the Zobels also subject to anti-Semitic abuse in spite of the fact that they were not Jewish?
That's probably true, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that either.
I don't know that either.
Was there any component of that anti-Zobel campaign coming from the Native community? Because
I don't recall. You know, I was pretty young at the time. I remember it being I mean, it's the kind of thing we have now, right? Like people just like make him a scapegoat. I don't remember particularly where it was coming from or how focused it was. I remember Herb Shanlon's famous commentary. Ron Zobel trying to do to us what she, you know, when Penny Zobel got pregnant. Said Ron Zobel's trying to do to us what he's already done to Penny.
Yeah, that's just the charming things that Star said.
I don't want to take us off the Zobels till you're ready, but you started into the story that I was confused, and I wonder if you could elaborate in reading your paper, the difference in perspective between Hickel and Hammond and how they perceived the value, the wealth that comes from the people's oil, and how I got twisted around, because I would have thought that politically I would be more aligned with a Hammond-esque, and yet Hickel, I thought in your paper you described, was more speaking about the commons and the good of the commons and how everybody should benefit from this, not just individually, each of us to do as we wish.
Right.
And so I got confused, and then
at the end of your
paper you said, you know, so I like what Hickel said, but Hammond was right. And I would just wonder if you could elaborate or if I misread that.
Well, I think, you know, that the Alaska that I preferred is the Hammond Alaska, which is kind of so I compared them in that column to Hamilton and Jefferson, you know, and Hammond being the Jeffersonian, which is kind of agrarian, small-scale, communitarian, you know, you sort of like, I mean, not communitarian, but self-reliant, and in the old-time Alaskan, which I'm sure a lot of people here remember, which we don't have anymore, right, when And Hickel was much more sort of the boomer and developer, and he wanted to build roads everywhere and build these big projects. And so, you know, in terms of the Alaska, and Hammond, I think a lot of his thoughts about preventing, you know, spending, in other words, saving money and then handing it out in these small chunks of the dividend, was an anti-growth concept. So, like, if we spend this money, then we get growth, then we get more roads, we get more economic development. I don't want that. I mean, he wouldn't say it in those so many words, but essentially, he wanted things to stay the way they were. He wanted rural Alaska to be the sort of center of gravity of Alaska, fishing industry. You know, he tried to start an agriculture industry, kind of on that same philosophy. It's like, let's be sort of self-sufficient resource state. Whereas Hickel's idea was, let's build this great society, let's make Alaska urban, which is Hamilton's idea as well, and creating the United States as like a big mercantile center, and, you know, doing everything he did to concentrate wealth in the cities. I'm not saying that Hickel was in any way the intellectual equal of Hamilton, I'm just saying that they sort of were on the same path. And you know, from a personality standpoint, you could say that Hickel was the optimist and Hammond was the pessimist. You know, you could say that really, I mean, Hammond considered him as a conservative because he wanted to conserve what was already there, which is essentially sort of a pessimistic, past-oriented point of view. And whereas Hickel, who was thought of as the conservative sort of politically, was actually interested in the future and in making everything different and moving us to a different kind of Alaska, which he saw as using the money to invest in capital projects. You know, in other words, you build university buildings, you build everything's the best, you build stadiums, you build roads, this brings construction, you know, and then the capital projects themselves build an economic base and everything, you know. And so to do that, to have those kinds of investments, you need to have a large amount of money that is concentrated in the government. And that's where he saw the oil money being spent, and he saw it correctly that it was a common good. You know, it's not an individually owned thing. It was intended to be to fund the government, and that's why he was really not a supporter of the permanent fund itself. And then once the permanent fund was created, he tried to turn it into what he called a community fund, where instead of paying a dividend, each community in Alaska would receive a pro rata or a per capita amount. So there might be a small dividend, but most of it would go, you know, to Fairbanks. You've got 80,000 people, so you get 80,000 dividends that then your local government could spend on projects. And that was his version of the dividend, because it was a sort of a more communitarian and investment-based point of view. You know, in the end, I think that I guess I wouldn't say one or the other was right. I think there are different perspectives on Alaska. If it were up to me, I think we would have. I think the best thing that would have happened is if Prudhoe Bay would have been about 20% the size it actually was. You know, if it had been much, much smaller, then I think Alaska could have grown in a much more healthy way with more of a real economy.
We would have been developed.
Yep, maybe not, or maybe it would have had to
develop
another way.
There's a lot of
20%
fields in Alaska.
But I think that, you know, if theoretically, if we could have gotten a lot less oil money over a longer time period, we would have been better off, because so much of the money was wasted with these boom and bust cycles.
But a more argument could be made that would have been, if we'd had different schedule for what we put into the permanent fund, the effect would have been similar.
Yeah, but I mean, Hugh Malone had the point, and he was the real father of the fund in a lot of ways, that he regretted creating the fund, because he said, we've created this sum of money which is so large in comparison to our population that it's going to distort everything we do from now on. And he sort of imagined, like, what if people realize how much money is there, and the fact that they could cash out and have more money in their hands than they'll ever have in their lifetime, individually. Which is the case.
Well, what they
and he thought that would be a disaster, and you know, one of the the permanent fund now contains more financial assets than every Alaskan owns personally.
How did they draw the longevity bonus into the permanent fund?
Well, the original concept of the fund back when the $900 million came in was that it would be a longevity bonus, and that didn't pass the legislature. That was Governor, I can't recall if that was Governor Miller's concept, but that was the idea that
but
it was.
For many years, they did, certain people did get longevity bonuses. Yeah.
But it was just paid out of annual, it was just paid out of the annual budget. It didn't relate to the permanent fund.
Oh, okay.
So it was just an appropriation that they paid. And then when, okay. when oil prices went down, I think in the 90s is when they got rid of it.
No, Ed, I think it was the Murkowski administration.
Murkowski.
Yeah. It was reduced in the 90s. And then Murkowski got rid of it entirely. Yeah.
I love this. I annotated particularly this paragraph, which talks about the early part of the... this is Dave saying, in your context, in your text, my ignorance of the fund's administration up to that date also created anxiety. Staff at the Department of Revenue had managed the fund's investments from their offices in the state office building. When I first visited there to size up the operation, I was shown into a conference room empty except for a copy paper box of files on the table with some yellow legal pads and pens. This was the Alaska Permanent Fund. this is just a great image. The box contained lists of assets totaling $3.5 billion, handwritten notes from Elmer Rasmussen, and copies of legislation, but no analysis of asset allocation, no meeting minutes, no performance measures, no policies on return or objectives or risk constraints. The trustees had made no formal decision on whether to have in-house staff manage the money or to contract with investment houses. Even after 6 years of debate, the basic person of the fund never had been articulated clearly, a prerequisite for designing a rational investment program. So that's what Dave faced when he came into the permanent fund. And it goes on to describe, he says, documents in the box also record a large unpaid obligation to the fund. The legislature had appropriated $900 million to the fund in 1980. In 1981, not to be outdone, the next legislature appropriated $1.8 billion. I discovered that the state had failed to deposit all the money into the fund. I mean...
Yeah, and then he...
I mean, it just goes on.
Then he sends the Governor Sheffield a comical sort of due bill, says, you know, you owe me like $1 billion. And Governor Sheffield did not think it was funny.
That's one way to handle it, though. I mean, that's really going to embarrass the governor. Right. That's good. Yeah.
But he got the money paid.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anyway, there's just, I mean, you can see how many orange stickies I've got in here, but there's just all kinds of little notes like that. Let's see, this one is dedicated openness of action.
One of the things that about those early years was that it's easy to forget, but when the stock market would go down, there'd be articles in the newspaper saying that Dave Rose lost $500 million, you know, and then he would make investment decisions, and that would be front page news. About, you know, how he decided to invest the money, or what he sold this or bought that, because people really had an awareness like this is a huge amount of money that belongs to us. And then as time has passed and the permanent fund sort of has been more and more successful, the state has been more permissive in the rules. I mean, there's essentially no rules at all now on how the permanent fund can be invested, and the media pays no attention to it at all, to the extent that we've actually gotten into some fairly questionable areas now. There's a significant amounts of the permanent fund that are invested in these, you know, black private equity holdings.
Yes.
Where there's no disclosure of what they are. You know, these hedge funds where the managers are paid enormous amounts of money, some of which have been incredible. I don't know if you guys have heard of Juno Pharmaceuticals, J-U-N-O Pharmaceuticals. Permanent fund invested in it, and they had some kind of miracle drug, and it's gone up orders of magnitude. I mean, for like in 1 year, they made numerous billions of dollars out of this company because the permanent fund was in on the ground floor, and it's sort of the kind of company that produces like Mark Zuckerberg like billionaires. But it just all flowed into the permanent fund, and then one day they had a problem, and like half of the money went away. So it's you know, now the fund is able to do these things, and no one really is paying any attention because in those early years it was so successful.
Carl? Several times you've mentioned, I think this last time you said the word permanent fund, you actually meant the fund itself. but a couple of times previously, I think you meant the dividend. Would you please properly elucidate which one you're talking about when you're talking about them? Because some people think that they're one and the same, that the fund is the dividend and the dividend is the fund. So I think it's important when you're trying to educate people that you make sure that they know what you're talking about when you're talking about it.
Yeah, and one of the most famous of those is people refer to it as the permanent dividend fund. Yeah. I mean, I've heard that hundreds of times from people. Mary?
Let me just start with a big thank you. I have really enjoyed your work over the years. You and Dermot keep us oriented, in my opinion. And I enjoy your father's work, too.
Thank you.
And his trying to figure out what happened at Murkowski's Conference of Alaskans when Jay Hammond stood up and things unfolded, to me, is just a real exposition of trying to understand who we are and how we go forward, given our whole suite of paradoxes. Mm-hmm. But to jump to this next bit about distinguishing the dividend, permanent fund, and the earnings reserve, your whole book with Rose, to me, just opened up the heroism and the risk and the kind of Wild West standoff at the door to the office, standing down the governor and saying, you know, you're going to have to ask formally for my resignation, not just imply that you want it. You know, I mean, it's heroism, it's drama. If you haven't read this book on the permanent fund, it's a wild read. And it also brings you up to date of where we are now and what kind of heroism, what kind of risk, what kind of, you know, what is our situation today? We don't have a banker's box with yellow pads in it. We've got this much larger, more complicated state, and everybody's making presumptions about what the permanent fund will do for us. And one of the things that has floored me as we move towards this new election cycle with our constitutional budget reserve diminishing as we sit here by the minute is this notion that we can rely on the money in the permanent fund, not in the corpus, but in the earnings reserve, because we're spending down everything else, that we can rely on the earnings reserve as some kind of fiscal cushion for the state. And David Teal, the legislator's budget guru, has made it really clear that the ERA shouldn't be viewed as a budget reserve, and points to the time, not that many years ago, when that earnings reserve account went down to zero almost. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people realize that could happen today. And then where would we be? With only corpus money that can't be touched, hardly no revenue outside royalty revenue from oil and gas, and $500 million of old tax revenue.
It will happen if the legislature doesn't really get going, and I've talked to enough legislators in the majority who just feel like the best strategy is just to hope that oil prices go up again. You know, they say there's really no emergency. We've got several years.
Oh, good Lord.
Who knows what
can
happen?
Can't hear you.
So the question is,
that's really terrible.
Pardon me?
We don't have David Rose. So is there anybody inside the permanent fund who's likely to stand up and say, this is the nature of the beast?
Well, I think that the attitude that the fund has taken and that Dave also took was that kind of like the corpus is my money, the earnings reserve is your money. And the earnings reserve has always been available for expenditure by a simple majority of the legislature and the governor's signature. And that remains the case. And that's sort of that's our hazard that we're facing, is that with that money sitting there, I think that they feel like it's not as urgent as it really is. Any kind of fiscal plan has to fill the gap using the reserves we have, taxes, reduced spending, reduced oil tax credits, and you can just barely make it work with the money that's in the earnings reserve now. If we spend down the CBR and the earnings reserve even one more year at the same level without doing those other things, it just doesn't work anymore. And what happens then is you run through the earnings reserve until it's gone. Obviously, you have to get rid of the dividend entirely. And then you face a situation where we can't function as a state. I mean, you can't take money out of the corpus without a vote of the people, which can only happen in a general election, so every 2 years. I think one of the big problems we face is that people haven't actually sat down and looked at the numbers. And as Dermot was saying to me the other day, the problem is that people are thinking millions when we're talking about billions. The numbers are so huge. So if we had a large income tax, larger than most states, we would raise maximum about $600 million towards our $3.2 to $4 billion deficit. In order to you know, even if you got rid of the tax credits, you said we're not going to use the dividend, we're going to cover this with taxes, you would have to pay as much or more state income tax as you pay federal tax. So, I mean, no state obviously comes anywhere close to that. If they spend through the CBR and through the earnings reserve, that's really all you've got left, right? I mean, you could obviously increase oil taxes, and you could massively increase. You drive the economy into depression, and you would have to cut a budget in a way that is almost unimaginable. So, they're definitely playing with fire, and the corpus is unavailable. I mean, if you hit that day, you still have to wait 2 years to have an election to take money out of the corpus. So all the, you know, you read the newspaper, you know, comments or letters to the editor and say, oh, we're rich, we've got $62 billion or whatever the current balance is. No, the money is completely unavailable.
And having Steve here made me aware, and also hearing a statement that Hickel made in this lecture I'm going to show next week, video, that Hickel said, okay, you have the, he used the ConocoPhillips as an example. ConocoPhillips may be a $40 billion company. It has 40,000 employees. We have, you know, $10 billion budget. We should have 10,000 employees. And cutting government, he says, you need that. You need the auditors. You need the checks on our revenue. You need people in schools and people in the highways department. You have to have a credible working government. You can't continue to cut. We need it more than anybody else because we don't have an infrastructure at the county level. We don't have any other government to help us get the revenues that we need.
But let me add to that. Department of Revenue, we have this net profits tax on the oil industry. So, I mean, that's ACES, that's SB21. That's why, you know, the idea is whatever's left over after their expenses, then we tax on the net profits. Well, as anybody knows who's been in business, if you get something on the net, you better know what those expenses are. Well, the Department of Revenue has 10 employees in its audit department. 10 low-paid civil servants who are so far behind on doing those audits that they're constantly at the edge of the statute of limitations of losing the opportunity to do the audits on the oil company.
Richard Feinberg has talked about this many, many times.
So that's how we're saving money. The Department of Commerce was cut by over 60% last year. The Economic Development section was cut from 12 employees to 3. All the economists in the Economic Development section were gone. They're working now on an economic development plan so it can diversify our economy, those 3 people, with a $100,000 grant from the federal government. So we're already at the point where we're eating the sea corn in this crazy, crazy way. I want to add one other thing that I said was a little inaccurate, because this hasn't been picked up on, and I almost don't want to tell people because the legislature, I don't know if they're going to figure it out, but the weird payout mechanism that we have from the permanent fund is that the realized earnings go into the earnings reserve account. So all other endowment funds, they have a investment objective, and then whatever that objective is goes for spending, And if you have an endowment, the federal tax code says you have to spend 5% of the endowment per year. This is not an endowment. This is an investment fund. And the realized earnings, well, what are realized earnings? That means dividends and interest and capital gains on stocks that have been sold. Well, the whole time for the permanent fund on a lot of stocks is for a really long time. So those realized earnings are growing, unrealized earnings are growing and growing and growing. Unrealized earnings stay in the corpus. If the rubber hits the road and we really get hit a problem, then I can imagine a governor telling the trustees,
cash out,
sell all the stocks.
Yeah.
Get all those capital gains, put them in the earnings reserve. That's like 25% of the fund, even a third of the fund. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, in that sense, the corpus is not safe.
Could a governor do that?
Well, I mean, Hickel's example is he is to fire the trustees. I mean, he already appoints several of the trustees or commissioners, so presumably
he'd
do it.
Yeah, but that's sort of... The red lights were flashing.
You'd definitely have a constitutional crisis, but yeah. I don't know what would happen in that situation.
But see, most people have never thought that far. You're saying some very important things. But Steve made it clear. And there's a section here where I say Cooper weighs in. This is in page 185. At our work session, Trustee Steve Cooper, no longer a member of the legislature, declared the fund's goal should be to provide recurring income for state government when our oil fields were depleted. He said that here, and then to keep our taxes low, but not to not have taxes. Mm-hmm. And if that were the goal, then a relatively straightforward equation could help define the fund's policies. Variables would include the annual income needed for state spending, the time left until the oil was gone, the size of deposits to the fund, and the rate of return on investments. In reality, however, adopting such a strategy lay well beyond our capabilities because the most important variables were unknown or beyond our control. True enough. Besides, at the time, the fund appeared unlikely to ever grow large enough to replace oil revenues. Though the discussion, the trustees were able to agree only on the original negative goal. Rogers, and that's
George Rogers,
I think, finally moved the meeting into a second item on the agenda with no resolution. To this day, the fund's income is mandated for dividends, inflation proofing, and whatever else the legislature chooses to spend it on, it has no clear objective. People think it does. They individually have a very high opinion of their own opinion on what it should be. But in fact, it really isn't a clear mandate for
the governor's veto of half of the dividend only kept that money in the earnings reserve account. It didn't devote it to any other purpose other than staying in the fund.
But that keeps the possibility of a dividend alive. Right. Yeah.
Regarding the veto by Walker, cutting the dividend or capping it at 1,000, this Anchorage legislator, whose name I can't pronounce.
Bill Willikowski.
Has sued, and I'm wondering what the feeling is about the success of that suit.
I've studied a little bit, and I've talked to some attorneys, and talked to Willikowski and Rick Halford, who's one of the plaintiffs. The other plaintiff is Clem Tillion. I think Willikowski feels he has a good suit. He seems to be a good attorney, and he's spent his summer poring through the recordings of the committee meetings from when the constitutional amendment was passed. He's hanging on his hat on a provision of the constitutional amendment that says that the earnings of the fund will flow to the general fund or to another account as determined by the legislature. And what his contention is that language overrides the constitutional provision that says that the state may only spend money through appropriation. So the appropriation language of the Constitution says that no state expenditure can happen except through appropriation. Appropriation can only happen by vote of the legislature that's not vetoed by the governor. Willikowski's position is that the constitutional amendment that created the fund bypass that by saying that the legislature could determine where, into what account the fund would flow. And since they determined that it would flow into, by statute, into the dividend fund, that overrides it. Lawyers that I've talked to, including my dad, who was there, don't think that you'd have to, if that's what they intended, they would have had to say something along the lines of, notwithstanding the provision of the Constitution that says you have to appropriate funds, this is different. And that's how it's been interpreted since 1983. It's always been appropriated. So I think his suit is not very likely to succeed, but you never know. It could succeed. If it does, boy, chaos ensues, because it will certainly not happen before like October 8th, which is when the checks are being sent out. Even if it did, obviously you'd have to recalculate and recut the checks and the whole thing. If it gets resolved 2 years from now, then what, do you have to take the $666 million and send it retroactively to those same people? I mean, it's just a big can of worms. Wilikowski's other point is, his number one point is he thinks that the oil companies aren't paying enough. So he doesn't want he sees the reduction in the dividend as being a head tax, which I think is essentially true. And as long as the oil companies aren't paying their fair share, he's going to stand firm against a head tax. So that's the principal point of view. His other point of view is that if the governor can veto the dividend at any time, it completely changes the balance of power in Juneau, and means that the legislature will never pass a fiscal plan. Why should they, when the governor can take the heat?
Well, that's the utterly dismal theory. We're all gonna die. Okay. Yeah, well, the governor's taking the heat, but the other problem with Wilikowski's approach is he wants to make the dividend a constitutional amendment. I mean, that's a terrible idea.
We discussed this last night, and I think that you remember the Conference of Alaskans, Murkowski's session, that was one of the proposals, enshrine the dividend in the Constitution, but cap it. If we had done that, our fiscal situation now would be vastly, vastly improved. And I think at the time, polling said that the public would support that. Now, why would they support it? If you remember the 99 vote, when Knowles brought forward his plan, it was just essentially a blank check. I mean, you would look at it and say, they want to spend the dividend on state government. Well, how much? How do we know they're not going to spend more? You know, how do we know it's not a slippery slope? I voted against it, you know? The beauty of enshrining the dividend in the Constitution is you make a deal with the public and you say, yeah, your dividend is going to be protected. It's going to exist. Anything over this amount will be spent on government. Okay, we've now made the deal. It can't be changed. I think that part of the problem of the situation we're in now is nobody wants to go first. The people who don't want to pay income taxes don't want to go first. The oil industry doesn't want to go first.
Yeah.
People who get dividends don't want to go first. Everybody sees, like, what is this deal we're going to cut? What's my share going to be? And the best thing that could happen for those low-income and rural Alaskans that need the dividend is to set a figure. I think 1,000 is reasonable. And I would love to enshrine it at 1,000 in the Constitution. And then anything over 1,000, which will every year grow larger and larger and larger until that 1,000 is just a small portion of it, is available for government.
Well, I would urge that does not, we had had some discussion here earlier. One of the things that worries me is that, viewing the long haul, it assumes that the return on the permanent fund will be enough to keep putting a surplus into the permanent fund earnings reserve. That may not be true. You're counting on the permanent fund always being successful as it has been in the past. You know, every time you get a statement from a stockholder or a stock corporation, they'll say, past performance is not a prediction of the future. You know, I've been hearing things, and Dave can reaffirm this, about college endowments, that
You know, if you look at what's happening in the investment world, CDs are almost paying nothing. Some places in Europe are actually in deflation. Many endowments are not meeting their expectations. There's, you know, growth has been really flat, especially in the last 2 years. There are reasons from my study in my career that oil prices and oil production and the energy expenditure of oil production may mean that that is more the norm than the past in terms of the ability to grow money from interest, from simple interest. So that's why I don't want to put the permanent fund dividend into, because it guarantees you take it whether it's there or not, or whether it's earning or not. That's why I didn't like the POMV idea. You take 5.5% or 5% every year, depending. Well, look at the earnings for the permanent fund this year. It was negative in the third quarter. You know, it's maybe got 1.8% growth. You take $1,000 a pop out of that every year, and sooner you don't have any earnings reserve. So I just think, you know, if you want to guarantee people to take from something that is unpredictable in the future, you're really, that's a bad risk to me.
Right. I think I would put a cap. I don't think I'd put a floor, but yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah. I'd say that the, you know, the dividend,
but people will read it as a,
well, I mean, I think you'd say something like, you know, it'd be distributed on this formula basis, you know, capped at this figure or something like that. But
okay, that's better. But I'm just saying, there are many things I'm very liberal about, but economics is something I'm very conservative about, because I just, you know, I think economists are not the highest level of science that I've ever. They don't do repeatable experiments. That's the problem.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that bipartisanship has been gerrymandered out of the legislature. Mm-hmm. And all I know is what I read in the newspapers. They don't mention much about SB 21. It's not really in there. What we talk about is what the newspapers say is everybody's obsessed with the dividend. Here's a quote from when the U.S., when we were colonies. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits for the public treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy. That's where we're at. And we're not talking about SB 21, which is where we can tax ourselves silly. SB 21 and lower budget, but SB 21, which even the governor is afraid to take on. And a lot of that is, and it's not just Alaska, it's a lot of places across the U.S., ALEC, et cetera. Bipartisanship is gerrymandered out. There's no discussion. It's like Tammany Hall. You ask the mayor, what are we going to do? He says, I don't know. They haven't told me yet.
Right. Well, here's the problem. I've always been a hawk on taxing the oil companies more. I've always felt like, you know, tax them too much and the oil stays in the ground, not a problem. We can always get it out later, right? You know, I've never felt like we need to have lower taxes to have, you know, more rapid oil development, because the longer they keep the oil, you know, the better in one sense. But that said, the SB 21 versus ACES debate is kind of irrelevant in the current situation, because they're both net profits taxes. And the oil industry's net is not very good now. I mean, the fact is that Alaska is a territory where it costs a lot of money to produce oil, and I believe that a lot of our oil fields are just breaking even at this point. So if you have a net profits tax, you're just not going to get much. Now, if you had a tax on the gross, you could get a lot more. You would then be taxed. You would then be taxing, you would then be forcing the oil companies to have more red ink in Alaska. I mean, obviously they'd be losing money if you were taking beyond their net profits. I don't know how sustainable that is, you know, or that it would work. But so the tax regime we had before, what was the Murkowski's tax? We had ELF, and then Murkowski for 1 year had his system. Then Palin brought in ACES, which was supported by the Democrats and had these escalators. That's where we got all these huge savings that we have now, is in those high oil years. We had ACES, which had all these escalators. Then SB 21 came in, and it took it down all those escalators, but then the oil price dropped. And so the analysis is that SB 21 and ACES are really, at this price, about the same. Not much difference, because the price is low, and there's just not that much profit to be taxed.
But we tax the net, and there's no oversight.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Don?
I completely agree with that analysis, except there's one nagging problem. That when you look at the cost of production, and Dermot wrote an article about that, all of a sudden after SB 21, all of a sudden the cost of production tripled. Or
right.
More than double.
Which goes to those 10 people in the revenue department. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yeah. Nobody in their right mind would believe any of that crap. Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden
you go to this. So what is the real cost of production? I mean, 3 years ago, suddenly the cost more than doubled? I mean, that's.
Well, if you think about the pipeline, which is the big oil companies own the pipeline, the more it costs to ship oil through the pipeline, the more they pay themselves, and the less the oil is worth at the other end, and then they pay a tax on the net. So, I mean, it's a great system for them.
Always has been.
Yeah.
Well, it's been shown that they've overpriced
right.
the flow through the oil. I have one more thing, then I'm going to let it go, but I couldn't escape. Could you tell us about the Kuwaiti offer for the BP Oil Corporation? Do you remember that? I'll refresh you here.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Oh, yeah, right.
Later, I was invited to serve as director in some large public companies. I was intrigued by the challenge and attracted by the offer of director's fees, but when I discussed this with Board of Trustees, I was reminded of my own words about keeping a solid wall between our trust and the companies in which we invested. Of course, the trustees were right. The concept worked both ways, whether the issue was voting proxies for social causes or sitting side by side with other board members. The Alaska Permanent Fund should remain aloof from every outside influence. The most significant opportunity of this kind came from Fuad Jafar. I think that's from the Aladdin movie. Jafar is the bad guy in the Aladdin movie. He was general manager of the London-based Kuwait Investment Organization, who invested its Future Generations Fund. Interesting name. It was one of the few successful oil well savings accounts in the world. The Kuwaiti Fund came into existence thanks to a single official in that nation's non-democratic government who set aside the money.
Illegally.
It came to pass that's true, yes. While transparency and openness defended the Alaska Permanent Fund, secrecy was the Kuwaiti Fund's best defense. Prior to the Iraqi invasion in 1990, this fund was the biggest in the world, containing assets roughly estimated at $100 billion. Only Jafar and his colleagues knew the real value. I liked Jafar and invited him to visit Juneau. Okay, this is great. I never knew this happened, but he suggested he stay at our home, and I was inclined to agree, but I first conferred with Fran, this is his wife. It would be simple, I told her. We could move into a basement and give Jafar and his retinue the upper level of the house. She was amenable to this arrangement until the matter of security came up. Jafar's pilots, who were also his bodyguards, carried machine gun pistols at all times. A good Jewish girl from Queens, Fran couldn't accept the idea of a bunch of Arabs running around the house with heavy-duty automatic weapons. This is just great. Later, Jafar approached me with a big idea. He suggested that his Kuwait Fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund, and the California Public Employee Pension Fund and Teachers Retirement Funds should pool their proxies to take control of British Petroleum. Which is interesting, since British Petroleum is a very big player in Alaska. Originally, I had met with Jafar through real estate, our funds jointly controlled, but we'd never considered anything like this. I have to admit, for a moment, it was an appealing idea. BP was one of the two largest producers on Alaska's North Slope, as well as one of the greatest oil companies in the world.
Oh my.
The idea of controlling its board from my office in Juneau briefly went to my head. Yay!
Jafar, I'd think about it, but not much thinking was needed before I realized the move would violate our principle of separating politics, corporate governments, and our trust responsibilities. Besides, if Alaska controlled BP, with whom would we negotiate ourselves? The people of Alaska never gave me that job. I tried to explain all this to Jafar, but he kept saying, "You haven't given me a good reason." He laughed heartily and told me the pension funds in California had given him the same reason. Later, Britain passed a law limiting foreign ownership in BP. Sadly, Jafar lost his job over legal troubles related to dealings in Spain, and the Kuwait fund was depleted in rebuilding the country after the Iraq invasion. Interesting little vignette of history there.
And he created the fund by just taking money off the books, unaudited books, and just putting it aside without anybody knowing about it. I mean, that was, but then he got, later on when he did that kind of business on his own behalf, he got in some trouble.
Yeah, but $100 billion, that's pretty good for the country if they can
come
to fruition.
But I mean, it was never any official policy they were going to save that money. He just managed to take it off the top.
Yeah, wow.
Is there a way we can get a copy of that book?
Yeah, I sent, well, you weren't on the list, but I sent it out to everybody. That he could have brought some up.
I did bring one, but it's
not in print anymore. But the publisher has it, the publisher is it's the
Epicenter Press.
Epicenter Press, the former Fairbanks.
I think Fran has some copies. I think I have some copies, but I couldn't find them.
Okay, but I wanted the hard copy because books that I value highly, I put in hard copy. But there are soft copy versions available, about 90 copies that the publisher still has. And you can get it on the web, but I would like to go through Gulliver's because there are local folks.
Can they get it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Only a few copies from the original. I had them go to the original because I was looking. They had one copy in their basement of the hard copy that I bought from Gulliver's, but a lot of copies.
So when you're saying get it on the web, you're talking the paper?
Both kinds, yes. Somebody has them stockpiled somewhere in Canada or whatever.
If anybody wants one, I have one in Eric's car.
But it's a terrific read, and it's a very important historical piece for Alaska. Yeah.
Is yesterday's show going to be redone?
It's podcast already. I've been told on APRN. You can get the podcast.
Yeah, you could just. It's alaskapublic.org.
Yeah.
Okay. Next week, I hope to have Dermot here talking about the dividend. He's been doing a lot of research on the permanent fund dividend, and we talk about the dividend. But thank you so much. Keep